Welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you programs dedicated to the life of the mind. The Study hit the road in 2010, the main trip being to Southern Africa to further indulge our passion for sites of human evolution. The highlight of my pilgrimage is to famous caves, rock art sites and museums was a visit to Francis Thackeray, one of South Africa's leading archaeologists. I recorded this interview in his Johannesburg apartment, where Hadada ibises and barbets still chip in along with the neighbour's pets. Rather than make hard decisions about cutting this interview down, I've split it into two parts. The first part here is focused on subjects like the importance of teaching evolution and the role of museums in that, and also to a variety of questions about how evolution happened and what we know about it.
Well, I was born in Pretoria in the early 1950s. My father was an astronomer at the Radcliffe Observatory, which was at the time the largest telescope of its kind in the Southern Hemisphere. This was in the 1950s. And I had a wonderful childhood. The observatory was situated on 50 acres of property, and it was a huge garden for me, with a forest, with wildlife. I kept a little museum at the bottom of the garden, and then I took a strong interest in the Transvaal Museum of Natural History in the center of the city, and I was encouraged to take my grasshoppers and my insects for identification at the museum. And this was when I was very young, when I was about 6 years old. And when I was seven, I became interested in rocks and fossils, and I was given the huge privilege of being taken to the Sterkfontein Caves by Dr. John Robinson, who was the assistant to Dr. Robert Brum, and together Robinson and Brum had found Mrs. Pless, a celebrated fossil from the Sterkfontein Caves that was discovered in 1947. And in the late 1950s, I was taken to Sterkfontein by John Robinson, and I was allowed to collect fossils for the museum from a dump that the miners had discarded. So that was my introduction to paleontology, and it couldn't have been a more stimulating one. I went to a small school in Pretoria initially, Waterkloof House Preparatory School, and the exciting thing there was that in the late 1950s, the cricket field had to be levelled, and the bulldozers moved in and exposed a prehistoric assemblage of stone artifacts. And when I was about 7 years old, I was taught how to identify stone artifacts. I helped establish a museum at the school where the stone artifacts were put on display. And that was a very stimulating part of my school education. I went on to high school in Pretoria and then down to Cape Town to the university there, where I studied zoology and archaeology in the early 1970s, at a time when there was no formal paleontological course, but I took zoology as the closest subject to paleontology. I did a little bit of archaeology and environmental studies degree for my master's, and then I went to Yale University in America with my wife, Anne. She is an archaeologist who works on stone tools, stone artifacts. I work on fossils. And together we did an excavation for our PhD degrees in anthropology. We did our fieldwork in South Africa at a cave called Vonnewerk, which goes back something like 2 million years.
About collecting, I mean, that was obviously important to you as a child. Do you have any particular thing to say about that explanation for it, why people collect?
Especially
in natural history, it's a great tradition with people like Lewis Leakey, and that came naturally to people like that. I think Darwin, and, you know, there's a whole tradition there.
Well, when I was very young, I did establish a little museum, personal collection of rocks and fossils. I was very lucky to go to England in 1961, and I was given the opportunity to go and look for fossils in chalk quarries. And there I found shark's teeth and marine shells, and then I also found stone artifacts, which simply became part of my collection, but it was a natural kind of thing to do. I had wonderful parents who supported my interests. In fact, they were always a little bit alarmed as to what might be in certain boxes in the house when I was collecting spiders and scorpions and snakes. I had a snake as a pet for a period of time. I had a wonderful big spider. In South Africa, we call it a baboon spider. It's actually very much like a tarantula. So my parents were a little wary of what I brought back and put into boxes, but I had a wonderful childhood.
The main game here, which is evolution, of course. To me, I think it is the big story to come out of science. The whole science project, the main thing it's ever achieved in Western culture, to me, is to bring out the fact that evolution happened and the story of human evolution. I think the only other thing that might challenge it as a significant thing is maybe the discovery of life elsewhere in the universe, which hasn't happened yet. Before we actually talk about evolution itself, I think it's very important how it's written about and disseminated in popular culture, as we discussed today when we went out to Sterkfontein Museum, for example, and you've got your Origin Centre here at the university. And I remember when I met you in Mildura, you said you were unable to teach evolution under apartheid. So I'm wondering, you know, what was it like back in those days to learn about evolution at all? And how do you think things have changed now, presumably for the better, for getting the story across to the public?
Yes, well, in the 1940s, the Conservative Nationalist Party came into power, and evolution was forbidden as a subject in schools. This related in part to the very conservative view of the Dutch Reformed Church. Many of the politicians in power were closely associated with the church, and indeed, at schools throughout the country, evolution was not a subject to be taught. I was lucky enough to go to a school where we had an excellent history teacher, and he went outside of the curriculum and gave us a wonderful lecture. I remember it so well. It would have been in the early 60s, 1960s, at a time when evolution was certainly not taught officially. But he gave us a lesson on the timeline, from the time the Earth formed all the way through to the time of the earliest life, bacteria that was thought to exist many billions of years ago. Now we know that in both Australia and in South Africa and in Greenland, there are rocks which are in the order of 3.5 billion years, which have cyanobacteria. And, well, in my early history lesson, I just knew that there were very early forms of life many billions of years ago. And this history teacher then went on to talk about the diversity of life changing through time. So, yes, he was talking about evolution, but I can't remember that he actually used the word evolution in his lecture. At about the same time, the museum in Pretoria, the Natural History Museum, had exhibitions which featured Mrs. Ples, a distant relative of humankind, shown to be a distant human relative with a black skin. The Dutch Reformed Church and the politicians objected and actually asked the museum authorities to remove this exhibit showing a black Australopithecus as a distant ancestor of humanity. This was in the 1960s. Well, eventually the museum had to comply, that was just one example of how a museum couldn't make its own decisions about what should be exhibited. And then I should mention museums again came in to try to tell the story of evolution without using the word evolution. And Dr. Bob Brain, the director of the Transvaal Museum, in the 1970s put on an exhibition which showed the story of life, and it showed evolutionary trees, but the E word, evolution, was never used. He called the first hall the Genesis Hall, Genesis to refer to the origin of life, and he did indeed have a wonderful exhibition showing the rocks from the Barberton area in South Africa, where we have these very early forms of cyanobacteria, very early forms of life. So the story of evolution was told by South African scientists during the period of apartheid. I was never taught evolution formally at high school, but we were taught about the diversity of life in the animal and the plant kingdom as we know it today. However, I was able to go to Sterkfontein myself and to meet John Robinson and to develop an interest in stone artifacts and fossils while I was still a schoolboy. My parents took me to the Victoria Falls. The whole Thackeray family went to the Victoria Falls along the Zambezi River, which formed the boundary, part of the boundary between what was then northern Rhodesia and southern Rhodesia. And this was in 1960. I met Desmond Clarke, who became the leading African archaeologist, the leading archaeologist on Africa, on African prehistory. I met him when I was 7 years old, and I learned how to identify stone artifacts, and I was able to take my little collection of tools to him at the museum in Livingston, in what is now Zambia. And I showed him my tools, and he congratulated me. Indeed, I had found artifacts that were probably only less than 10,000 years in age, but it made a big impression on me. So while I was a school kid, even though I wasn't learning formally about evolution in the classes, I certainly was picking it up through the people that I met.
One other thing I remembered about Mildura was that you had a program to spread a Mrs. Ples model to all schools, I think. I was sort of wondering how that's going. And
yes. In 1997, I was elected president of the Paleontological Society of Southern Africa, and I presented my presidential address, and I said, I have a dream. My dream was to have one replica of the Mrs. Ples fossil in every school in South Africa. In the course of the last 13-14 years or so, we have literally produced hundreds of replicas of Mrs. Ples and other fossils, and many of these have reached schools. When I was at the Transvaal Museum, we had a very good educational program, and schools that came to see our exhibitions on human evolution took away with them a replica of Mrs. Ples. We've also had a walking tall program through the Paleontological Scientific Trust, the PAS Trust. They take into schools a little play which is acted out by school children, and it tells the story of evolution. And this was another way in which we could get replicas of fossils into the schools in a learning context.
How would you think that the story of evolution is generally understood now in the, within the general community, and whether it's accepted or not?
Well, fortunately, we now have evolution in school curricula in South Africa. This has happened only recently, but I've been very, very grateful to the South African government for the measures that have been taken to have evolution included in the new curricula. Government has also provided substantial amounts of money for upgrading of facilities at Sterkfontein, for example, where there is now a very good little museum, and tours are arranged. Members of the local community have been trained and take groups of people through the caves and talk about Mrs. Ples and Littlefoot and other fossils from those remarkable deposits which go back 2 to 3 million years. The government has also provided support for our Institute for Human Evolution and for the Bernard Price Institute for Paleontology. We've had substantial amounts of money for the upgrading of our Institute for Human Evolution. This comes through the Government Department of Science and Technology. I am currently in touch with the Deputy Minister of Science and Technology, and also to some extent with the Minister, Naledi Pandor, who was formerly Minister of Education. And we welcome government support for the teaching of evolution and for encouraging more young South Africans to turn to paleontology as a career. This was actually behind my dream of having one replica of Mrs. Ples in every school. It's in order to stimulate young school children, to stimulate them and hoping that one day they may turn to paleontology as a career.
It's probably unnecessary to ask you after what you've already said, but the role of museums in all this is obviously critical, isn't it?
Natural history museums in South Africa are remarkable. We have incredible collections of fossils, not only from the Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site, from caves such as Sterkfontein, Swartkrans and Kromdraai. We also have collections of fossils from the Karoo, an area where Robert Broom worked, collecting fossils that are about 250 million years old that represent the ancestors or the distant relatives of all mammals. So natural history museums in this country are very strong. We also have dinosaurs. South African dinosaurs go back about 200 million years. We have the archosaurs, which are ancestral to dinosaurs. And it's remarkable that these natural history museums in South Africa, in Cape Town, in Pretoria, in Bloemfontein, in Natal, do have this remarkable paleo-biodiversity, and we can be very proud of our South African heritage as part of world heritage.
The big subject, of course, is human evolution. I guess the obvious place to start is the origin of genus Homo. I remember also at the WHHO conference in Mildura where I met you, you spoke about the species boundaries breaking down, that more specimens showed overlap with of specimen properties, and we're talking about Australopithecus, Paranthropus and Homo. There's been such a plethora of different specimens discovered over the years, right up until very recently now with Sidiba. I'm wondering if you can give us some sort of broad overview of where the argument is and if there's any sort of consensus as to what the lineage is or what the main theories are about the lineage.
Well, I think we should begin by referring to Professor Raymond Dart, an Australian who came out to South Africa, and in 1924, the first fossil of Australopithecus africanus was discovered. It was described by Raymond Dart, who was based at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg. It was described by him in Nature, a leading scientific journal, in 1925. So that was actually very exciting. It was greeted by a great deal of skeptics. People from around the world didn't agree with Raymond Dart that the Taung child, as it was called, the young child from Taung, was really a distant relative of Homo sapiens, which is what Raymond Dart had claimed it to be. In fact, Raymond Dart had suggested that this was in line with Charles Darwin's view that Africa was the continent from which humanity had evolved. And It took many decades before the world came to accept Australopithecus africanus, the ape-like creature from South Africa. It took a great deal of time for it eventually to be accepted. One has to remember, of course, that Piltdown had been a problem. It was a hoax or a joke perpetrated in around about 1912, and this was a large-brained creature with an ape-like jaw, whereas the Tongan child was small-brained, and in some respects it had human characters. Like, it walked erect. We know that from the position of the foramen magnum, the Tongan child, when alive, would have probably been bipedal, which was a human character, and yet it had a small brain. This was the reverse of what has been found at Piltdown. Of course, now we know Piltdown is rejected. Eoanthropus was rejected. But Australopithecus africanus came to be accepted, I think not coincidentally, after the Piltdown man had been recognized as a hoax, or as a joke. And that wasn't until Kenneth Oakley and others had done chemical analysis on the fossils and detailed microscopic analysis to show that Piltdown was a combination of an orangutan jaw with a human cranium. It was a joke perpetrated around about 1912. Well, in the 1950s, after Piltdown had been exposed, people then really began to pay attention to the South African fossils. There were numerous visitors who came to South Africa to look at the fossils, to see the sites. It included the Abbé Breuil from France and others. And by the 1950s, it was recognized that Australopithecus africanus, as described by Raymond Dart, was a valid genus, valid species, and also a hominid. Now, that was the kind of beginning. Since then, since 1925, we have had indeed hundreds of hominid fossils from various sites in Africa. And as the sample sizes have increased, so too the boundaries between the taxa have begun to break down. This is very similar to what happened with Charles Darwin when he began collecting barnacles. In 1851 and again in 1854, he wrote two thick books on barnacles and barnacle diversity. When he started with just a few barnacles, he could classify them very easily by pigeonholing them into one or other genus and into one or other species. But he began to become very uncomfortable as the sample sizes increased from around the world. He was getting people from around the world to collect barnacles for him. The sample sizes showed that the boundaries between his species were breaking down. And that happened as sample sizes increased. Well, coming back to hominids, in 1925 we had the first specimen of Australopithecus africanus. Since then, we've had Australopithecus robustus, Australopithecus boisei, Australopithecus ethiopicus, Australopithecus Burrell Ghazali, and many others. Well, we've also had specimens of early Homo, like Homo habilis, described by Lewis Leakey and Philip Tobias and John Napier in 1964, an early form of Homo. And we've also had forms of Homo erectus, which are now known as Homo ergaster. And now that sample sizes have increased, we recognize that the boundary between the genus Australopithecus and the genus Homo has indeed broken down in the same way that the boundaries between barnacle species had broken down for Charles Darwin. And what Charles Darwin had said in 1851 and 1854 applies to what we are now faced with in the context of human evolution.
Do you have any comment on the role of the Rift Valley and its formation in this? And there is this argument that it it may have actually been a driver of evolution, or on the other hand, I guess if you come from southern Africa, it's completely irrelevant. So do you have a comment on that?
Well, the Great Rift is an area where there have been major changes in habitat within the last 5 million years. But we believe that it's not just driven by geological processes. One has to think of changes in temperature, global changes in temperature, contributing to changes in rainfall. So, for example, 4 to 5 million years ago in many parts of Africa, it would have been both warm and wet. The warm conditions would have been associated with more evaporation of water off the oceans. In some parts of Africa, between 4 and 5 million years ago, it would have been warm and wet. And with the warm, wet conditions, of course, habitats would have been associated with extensive woodland and forest in many parts of Africa. Now, temperatures changed. Temperatures actually began to decline. There was global cooling between 3 and 2 million years ago. And irrespective of whether you're in the Rift or in South Africa, I believe that the gradual episodic change in temperature contributed to changes in habitats, which influenced the distribution and abundance of animals, whether these were antelope or rodents. The changes in the distribution and abundance of the fauna was, of course, associated also with genetic changes. Gene pools would have been affected because of changes in the distribution and abundance of organisms. The population structure would have been changed. If you've got isolations occurring, you would have got genetic drift. And with that, you would have had changes in morphology, in the anatomy. So it's all linked. I wouldn't necessarily want to say that it was driven entirely by temperature, but we do know that irrespective of where you are in Africa, the changes in temperature would have contributed, would have driven changes in habitat to a large extent. And with the changes in habitat, you get changes in the abundance and distribution of animal populations. With that, you get changes in genes. With that, you get changes in anatomy. And the major challenge now is to try to bring together all this wonderful data from many fields of paleoanthropology and paleoenvironmental studies to integrate the data to tell the story of human evolution in the context of major changes in climate.
The scavenger versus hunter debate. We've got Raymond Dart and Bob Brain, and was it Lewis Binford, I think, put up, you know, this hunter versus scavenger dichotomy. Where do you think that's the consensus about that is now?
Well, Raymond Dart, in his work at Makapan's hut in the Limpopo province, north of Johannesburg, in the early years, he spoke of hominids, Australopithecus in particular, Australopithecus Prometheus, he called it, that they were able to use not only bone, but also horn and teeth as tools. And now we know that actually his theory was flawed because carnivores, hyenas in particular, would have contributed to the assemblage of fauna in the cave deposits, and natural factors, taphonomic factors as we call them, related to the processes of burial, all of them contributed to a pattern that Raymond Dart had actually mistaken as being something associated with human behavior, whereas actually carnivore activity and natural processes of preservation would have contributed to the pattern. Now, Bob Brain recognized that Raymond Dart wasn't correct, but Dr. Brain worked for many years at Swartkrans, a cave next to Sterkfontein, and at Swartkrans, going back more than a million years, between 1 million and 2 million years, at Swartkrans There were two species. One was called Australopithecus robustus, otherwise Paranthropus robustus, and early Homo, an early form of Homo, which many people regard as Homo ergaster. So we had the two species. And on the one hand, we believe that carnivores, including leopards, contributed to the accumulation of bones of the cave, and the carnivores, such as leopards, would have killed Australopithecus robustus, taken the carcasses up a tree, and then discarded the bones which fell into the cave. The bones were covered by sediment and then were cemented by limestone. Lime-rich water would have percolated through the sands and cemented those breaches. Well, that relates to carnivore activity. Carnivores, such as leopards, taking bones up into a tree and discarding them. That's clearly carnivore activity. Now, what Bob Brain has recognized is that at Swartkrans, there may well have been hominids, early Homo in particular, that had the ability to keep the carnivores at bay through perhaps the use of fire. At Swartkrans, there are burnt bones going back at least a million years, bones that were burnt at very high temperatures, between 600 and 700 degrees Celsius, which is the kind of temperature you have when you have a controlled fire. And Bob Brain has published in the journal Nature his view that fire was used in a controlled manner at Swartkrans by hominids such as early Homo that could have kept carnivores away. And Paranthropus or Australopithecus robustus may well have been victims of leopard predation. Well, I've extended the work of Dr. Bob Brain. I've been working at another site on the other side of Sterkfontein, a cave called Krumdry, where we do have carnivore activity in the form of saber-toothed cats, a saber-toothed cat known as Dino Felis, Dino Terrible Felis cat, and we know that saber-toothed cats were probably killing animals and bringing the bones to the Krumdry cave, the Krumdry A cave. Now, the story didn't end just there. Clearly, the adult saber-toothed cats were feeding the young saber-toothed kittens in the lair at Krumdry A. But we have also discovered through our excavations at Krumdry that there are stone tools there, but not a single hominid. We haven't found a single bone or tooth of Australopithecus or Homo. And what we've concluded is that hominids were probably scavenging. Hominids such as early Homo may well have been going to the Krumdry A site, perhaps at times when the adult saber-toothed cats were not present, and that the early Homo were breaking bones to access marrow. We've come up with this hypothesis partly because we have found these stone tools, including polyhedral cores, which have traces of bone adhering to the edges of the stone tools. Now, we've recognized the presence of bone apatite from X-ray diffraction analysis on the working edges of these stone tools. The indications are that the hominids were present some of the time at the caves, but they may well have been scavenging from the carcasses discarded by the carnivores such as saber-toothed cats.
So Australopithecines would have had some stone tools, though? Would we conclude that?
In the case of Krumdry, this dates back to 1.8 million, and we know both from South Africa and from East Africa that this was a time when there was both early Homo, such as Homo habilis, as known from Olduvai Gorge in East Africa, as well as Australopithecus, notably Australopithecus robustus or Paranthropus robustus, at the same time. There is a current debate as to whether stone artifacts from places such as Swartkrans, Kromdraai, and Sterkfontein. Whether they were made necessarily by Homo, or whether the robust Australopithecine may also have had the potential ability to use tools.
Well, I have read an argument that seems logical to me, that it's possible that one group invented using stone tools and another group copied it, and it looks like they originated, whereas the group that actually invented it pushed out of the picture.
Well, anatomists have looked at the hand bones of Paranthropus, Australopithecus robustus, and there's been a claim made on the basis of the anatomy of a thumb attributed to the robust Australopithecine that it had the potential ability to make stone tools. That isn't proof that the robust Australopithecine manufactured them, but it's a possibility.
The hand axe of the Acheulean, or Homo erectus, supposed Swiss Army knife. What's your view about what they were actually used for? And I believe they sort of tend to always accumulate near streams. So were they in fact missiles, or were they used as choppers, or were everything? Were they Swiss Army knives?
Well, I've seen hand axes in many parts of Africa, not only from places such as Vonneweg Cave in the interior of South Africa, or for that matter, bifaces at Sterkfontein, or from Olderwy Gorge, where I was privileged to stay. Mary Leakey gave me the opportunity to spend some time there and to live in her camp, and this was way back in the 1970s. I found many hand axes. I left them, of course, where they were. At Olagasali in Kenya, literally hundreds of stone artifacts. But it is interesting, most of these sites, if not all of them, are situated close to rivers. One thinks of Vonneweg Cave as being an exception. There certainly would have been populations of Homo erectus or Homo ergaster using these artifacts. I believe that they were used for many purposes. It was a multi-purpose tool, like a Swiss Army knife. They were probably used not only for breaking bone. I've argued that polyhedral cores may certainly have been used for that purpose, to break bone for marrow. There's no reason why a hand axe couldn't have been used for the same kind of function. I think marrow would have been a very important source of protein, so hand axes could have come handy for that. We know also from South Africa that in the early Pleistocene, the hominids were probably eating insects, including termites. Now, to access the termite, you've got to use a tool to break open the mound. It's been argued that bone tools could have been used for this purpose, but as I've indicated with Julie Lesnick, we published a short article saying that stones may well have been very effective in breaking open termite mounds. The sharp point of a hand axe would have been very effective to break the hard surface, the exterior surface of a termite mound. And once you've opened it up, you've got a veritable feast of protein in the form of termites.
Another little topic here, caves. There is this sort of contrast between East Africa and the gorges and the stratigraphy around there, as compared to so much of the archaeology in South Africa being in caves. So,
well, in South Africa, we have the remarkable accumulation of bones in the dolomitic solution cavities. As I described in the case of Swartkrans, leopards would have been accumulating bones in and around those caves. The leopards would have climbed up trees to get away from hyenas, which very often steal from leopards. The leopards will do the actual hunting. Very often hyenas will move in and drive the leopards away and feast on a carcass. Well, leopards have a strategy. They can climb up the trees, whereas the hyenas can't. So one scenario is that in the South African cave situation, you have carnivores, especially leopards, contributing to the accumulation of the fossils.
Well, I was thinking in terms also that probably more about the problem of age determination, the stratigraphy. It's more difficult here, isn't it?
Absolutely. In East Africa, there are the volcanic deposits, places like Olduvai Gorge, Lake Turkana, and you can date those deposits very accurately using potassium and argon, radioactive potassium, changing to stable argon. You can measure the ratio between those two to get a very precise age, and you are helped because there are volcanic ash deposits. In South Africa, for the period within the last 4 million years, we haven't had active volcanoes. So we cannot use that kind of radioactive dating technique. We are forced to rely on alternative techniques. We have been using biostratigraphy in a very general way, whereby we compare the fossils from the South African cave deposits with those from East African deposits, which can be dated using the volcanics, using potassium and argon. If you compare the fossil assemblages from different layers, you can get an estimate of the age. So, for example, Sterkfontein, without volcanic ash deposits, was dated between 2 and 3 million years, based on the presence of certain kinds of pigs, warthogs, certain kinds of antelope. They were used as an attempt to date those assemblages. Well, now we have new techniques. We have uranium lead dating, which is being applied to the study of the flowstones, the calcium carbonate deposits. We can also use paleomagnetism. I've had a lot of fun in getting a date for Mrs. Plez using paleomagnetic analysis. I worked with Joe Kirschfink from the California Institute of Technology to record the polarity of the sediments associated with Mrs. Plez in the context of the polarity of deposits above and below. And with Tim Partridge, the late Professor Tim Partridge, a date has been published of 2.15 million years for the age of Australopithecus africanus, represented by Mrs. Plez, an almost complete skull of that species. And uranium lead has now confirmed that it's in the order of 2.1 million.
The idea about that Louis Berger had about the Tung skull being collected by a bird of prey, there are actually myths about this giant eagles carrying off children in Southeast Asia and in Australia. I have an Aboriginal story about that. And there was, in fact, a giant eagle species in New Caledonia, which is now extinct. And now we've discovered Homo floresiensis. So there seems to me a potential, at least, truth in this. But I'm not sure whether the idea was accepted in terms of, as far as Tung went, anyway.
The Tung skull does indeed have damage, particularly in the area of the orbits. And this corresponds to the kind of damage that eagles inflict on the skulls of monkeys. These have been documented, very well documented, and Professor Lee Berger, as well as Ron Clark, many years ago, came up with the idea that the Taung child, as an individual that was probably about 3 years old at the time of death, was picked up and carried away by an eagle to the nest, and it's only the skull that has been recovered. But there is a great deal of support now for this hypothesis by virtue of the fact that studies have been done on assemblages of monkeys that have been killed by either crested eagles or the black eagle, which can certainly carry a young baboon, let alone a monkey. And it's entirely possible that the Tong child could have been carried some distance by an eagle about 2.5 million years ago.
Things have been fairly quiet in my study just lately. After my travels in southern Africa this year, there is still a process underway, a kind of digestion of what I encountered, investigated, and brought home. I have stones and raw ochre from the mighty Drakensberg Mountains and a Namibian granite range. Stones from locations where the sand bushmen painted their haunting images long ago.
Walking along the stream where the bushmen would have once walked, coming away from the cave. You can see it in the afternoon sun now on the hillside. Back up behind me with a Drakensberg in the background, it's spectacular.
I have pieces of calcite and dolomite from caves where our remote Australopithecine ancestors once lived, or more likely perished by falling in through the roof. In the unforgiving cradle of humankind where so much of our evolution took place, all perhaps 1,000 times longer ago than the days of the Bushmen. I went to a number of museums, of course, and most of these featured displays about human evolution, several being very good. I've always been attracted to dioramas. Indeed, I think they are an underrated art form. I particularly loved a series in the Transvaal Museum, now called Ditsong, in Pretoria. It had a fabulous quality in the older and better sense of the word. Yet it was indubitably grounded in scientific research, in historical fact. Indeed, it is hard to beat when you have a museum like this, where there is an extensive permanent exhibition about human evolution based on its own collections. The National Museum of Kenya in Nairobi is the only other one I know like it. I'm drawn to the whole idea of imagining the results of this science in dramatic form, of evolution happening to real living individuals. The Transvaal Museum also features a diorama of an Australopithecine being dragged away by a leopard that's got it by the head, its teeth puncturing the skull. This display is based on one of the most remarkable sets of fossils in the collections of any museum. They have the original skull and the leopard fangs. I think any good natural history museum should include this sort of exhibition, even if it is only based on a collection of plaster casts. I read the removal of a similar diorama of the leopard and Australo in the Australian Museum in Sydney several years ago. Also brought home, I have a replica of Mrs. Ples, the famous Australopithecine fossil discovered by Robert Broome at Sterkfontein in 1947. The unfortunate creature fell into a cave over 2 million years ago and couldn't get out. It's a nifty little model cast in epoxy resin, kindly presented to me by Stephanie Potzer, Mrs. Ples' curator in Pretoria. I also have a dazzling memory of the Tung Child skull being held up before me by Bernard Zipfel, curator of collections at the University of Witwatersrand. It is still there in the medical school, as it was discovered in 1924 by Raymond Dart, an Australian who was professor of anatomy there, a man who paid dearly for his discovery. Some, indeed, have written about how the Tung child almost seemed to discover Raymond Dart. It is our little ancestor, bearing the marks of probably being carried off by an eagle. I've said it before in a podcast, but the sheer fecundity of Africa, the life that swarms in its landscape, is to me quite special. It's a phenomenon that seems almost bound to throw up something strange. Somewhere in Africa, sometime in the Pliocene epoch, these little ape people became genus Homo, our mob. Strange how the waterhole keeps surfacing, so to speak, seems to draw us all in. Music in this program included my two themes, the Bach Prelude played by Ronald Farren Price and the Handel Suite played by Elizabeth Anderson, both from Move Records. Please see the website for full details of those recordings. So until next time, it's Shut the Door and Reading Lamp Only in the Study.